the gangster said impatiently. I'm sure you do, but it bears repeating. Are you sure this is what you want? I know my own mind, magician. You are consigning yourself to hell. Do you understand that? Where I shall be the devil, not one of his pitiful penitents. Believe me, I am aware of your superstitions. I shall be king there, just as I am king here, wherever there may be. And that was the end of the argument. I have prepared certain defenses. I shall have one of my men deliver them to you before the curtain goes up. Their use is self-explanatory. They are powerful magics, Seth, and once set in motion, they can't be recalled. Remember that. Time will try and fix itself. I'm absolutely sure of that. The longer Glasstown is removed from our today, the harder entropy will work to ensure that time finds its way in through any cracks or weaknesses in the lenses to where it is hidden. The glass must be maintained at all times. Should one anchor fail, the entire feat will come undone. And when it does, the years will catch up with you, Seth. You can't escape them. We are all beholden to time, even if it only feels like you've lived for a few weeks or months. If the lenses fail, you will experience the toil of every single lost year. You will age years in moments, and, if enough time has passed, you will die. Then they better not fail, was all the gangster said to that. Is owning her really worth all that? And more, Lockwood assured him. I love her, magician. One day you might be lucky enough to understand what that means. I'd move heaven and earth to have her. It is that simple. That absolute. I have made my peace with this, magician. I know what I am doing, what it means. But the simple truth is I cannot bear to be even a day out of her orbit. She is the earth to my moon. For all the poetry, all Damiola could see was madness in Lockwood's eyes. There was no love here. She will be mine, with or without your help. And your brother? Fuck him! I will do what I have to do, Damiola said, and knew he would. He hated himself for it, but he was weak, the last and greatest trick of his career. It would have to last him a lifetime. He never made it as far as the stage that night. The crowd formed a long line around the theatre, waiting for the doors to open, without realizing that Damiola was out there among them. He walked down the line, smiling to the few people who did a double take, almost recognizing him before he moved on to the next, until he found Eleanor Raines, deep in conversation with one of the women from that doomed film they were working on. No one seemed to understand that Reuben Glass was destitute, that the half-built Glasstown was the folly that ended him as a power player in the city, and that the movie he'd invested his fortune in, like the studio city he dreamed of, would never be finished. Hell, come sunrise, there would be no sign of him or his doomed empire anywhere in the city, including the streets it was built upon. Eleanor recognized him. Smiling, she introduced him to her companion.
Cadmus, this is Claire. She's the star of our picture. Claire, this handsome devil, is Cadmus Damiola, the star of the show we're all queuing up here so diligently to watch.
Charmed, the magician said, taking her outstretched hand and raising it to his lips.
Likewise,
Claire Greet said, offering a slight curtsy. In most companies, she would have been the most attractive woman present, but even her rare beauty paled beside Eleanor's.
I trust you are going to put on quite the show for us, Mr. Damiola.
He inclined his head slightly, a wry smile spreading across his lips.
I hope you will find it unforgettable, he said. If you would excuse me, dear lady, I need to talk to Eleanor.
Of course, of course. Don't worry, I'll keep our place in the line.
He ushered them away. Eleanor followed him to the street corner. He breathed deeply, knowing what was going to happen. It had all been carefully orchestrated like some grim dance.
He rested a hand on her shoulder. She looked at him. She knew something was wrong. He didn't waste his breath trying to reassure her.
What is it? What's wrong, Cadmus? What's happening?
It's your man, he said, not saying which corner of the love triangle he meant. Considering his profession, he was a lousy liar. The trick was to keep things as close to the truth as he could. He's in trouble. She looked nervously toward her friend, who was completely oblivious to their conversation, tapping her toe to some barely audible tune being pumped through tiny speakers in the awning, then back to Damiola. She trusted him. If he said Isaiah was in trouble, then Isaiah was in trouble. So many things communicated wordlessly between them. They all came back to the only word she said aloud. The one word that by chance meant he wasn't lying to her.
Seth.
He nodded. He's going to hurt him, he said, delivering the line in such a way as she couldn't possibly misinterpret the amount of pain involved.
You can't let him. Please, Cadmus, you have to do something.
He nodded again, hating himself.
I'll take you to him. Then the pair of you, you're going to have to run. Seth won't stop until both of you are dead. You do know that, don't you? He's obsessed. There's no happy ending here.
I know,
she said sadly, like she'd always known, but had been blind to it for the longest time, attracted to the flame of fame he promised, and knowing deep down she was going to get burned.
Where is he?
I'll take you to him, Damiola said.
She didn't know him as well as she thought she did. If she had, she'd have noticed the slight tick in his cheek that he got when he was lying.
What about the show?
We'll be back in time. Don't worry.
He looked up and down the street, seemingly checking for a taxicab. It had only been a few years since the city was awash with horse manure, with over 8,000 hansom cabs working the streets. But they'd all but died out over the last couple of years. Now the fares went to Austin lowloaders, with 8,000 of those trawling the streets for passengers. There was a horse-drawn four-wheel growler outside Kelly's across the way, and beside it a couple of rational motorcabs waiting for fares from the Savoy. Damiola had no intention of flagging down either. He raised a hand, catching the eye of Seth's man who was parked up 200 yards down the street. A minute later he was bundling Eleanor in the back of the car and giving the driver the address of one of the anchors. It was a relatively short drive. He had no urge to make small talk. The driver, though, was happy to fill the silences with a stream of barely comprehensible Cockney babble. The streets rolled by to his commentary. Damiola checked his pocket watch. Time was running out. If he didn't time the incantation to perfection, there was no telling what would happen. The only thing he knew for sure was that Seth Lockwood wouldn't accept failure. That was why he was doing it, he realized. It wasn't about helping Seth spirit her away. It was about banishing Lockwood from the streets he terrorized. When he thought of it that way, his cowardice was almost noble. They pulled up outside one of the many churches of London. This one was a little different as its gargoyles hid one of the magician's lenses, serving as an anchor point for his great conjuration.
"We're here," he said.
There were three men waiting on the church steps, their faces obscured by the shadows cast by the steeple. Reuben Glass stood beside Isaiah Lockwood. Isaiah came running down the steps toward them. Seth shoved him in the back, sending him sprawling down the stairs. He was on his hands and knees, battered and bloody from a proper beating, as they clambered out of the car.
"What have they done to you?"
Eleanor wailed, dropping to her knees beside the love of her life. She cradled him in her arms. She didn't care about the puddles or what they would do to her dress. Seth stayed up in the shadows. Misdirection. Showing the audience what they wanted to believe. The brothers were day and night to each other. One light, the other dark. One tall and thin, the other shorter, stockier. They should have been easy to tell apart. But she wasn't looking at what was in front of her. She was looking at what Damiola wanted her to see. That was the foundation for a lot of illusions. A wig to change the hair color, stoop a little to make yourself appear smaller, dress in your brother's clothes. The illusion will hold because it's not being scrutinized. Thinking it was Isaiah, she helped Seth stand, allowing him to lean on her. Seth didn't look up once. No eye contact. He lifted a dirty hand to his brow, and breathing hard, said,
"It is time, Cadmus."
Their voices were different, of course, and Seth made no effort to mask it. Eleanor wasn't listening for the subtle differences. She thought she was saving Isaiah, and nothing was going to change that until the denouement. And by that time, the trick would have been played, the outcome assured. She would only see what the magician wanted her to see until it was too late to change anything. He breathed deeply, calming himself. He was committed to this course of action. He had been ever since he'd taken the gangster's coin. You get involved with a man like Seth Lockwood, he's not content until he owns you body and soul. And he's always looking for ways to make it so. Damiola began to intone the first few words of the invocation, feeling the faint tingle beginning in his fingertips, spread quickly down the length of his arms, trammeling the bones of his ribcage to collide in a spark that ignited inside his heart, giving birth to the first true magic London had seen in generations. The words when they came were laced with the raw elemental energy of that spark. He raised a hand as though in farewell. A ghostly blue glaze engulfed it. Inside the glaze, the light crackled and sparked with life as he drew on the alignment of the elements around him, the unique power of the place, and in turn its place within time, to fuel what would be his last illusion. It still wasn't too late to back out, to turn around and walk away. As though sensing his moment of hesitation, Seth rasped two words.
"Do it!"
Damiola reached up, whispering the final syllables of damnation. The light sparked from his fingertips, hitting the lens in the center of the anchor and refracting to follow the precise lines he'd calculated that would take the light from lens to lens around the 13 anchors, completing the circuit of Glasstown. It was a heart-stopping few seconds while they waited to see if his calculations were right. And then the sizzling line of blue-white light came racing from the lens of the last anchor, streaking through the air to rejoin the first, completing the ring of blue 15 feet above their heads. The air stank of magic. He couldn't remember what it had been like before, when he couldn't smell the impossible. When you knew what you were looking for, it was unmistakable. It was all around him, in the fresh-cut grass, in the cinnamon from the bakery on the corner, in the thick, choking smog of the city, and every other incredibly vivid aroma. It was the essence of magic that amplified the natural odors, to the point that they were so much more powerful than any other smell in the vicinity. It wasn't some fragrance on its own. Standing there in the middle of the dirty East End street, it was the reek of garbage, of rotten cabbage and urine, so much stronger now than they had been when they'd emerged from the car. There were other fragrances that refused to be overpowered by the garbage, most notably the turgid smell of the river and its murky water. Seth grabbed Eleanor's hand and pulled her back behind the line of magic. She fought him instinctively, recoiling from his touch. She knew in that moment that he wasn't Isaiah, but it was too late for her. The air between them rippled like a summer haze. Seth turned her toward him, the wig on his head lopsided and almost comically covering half of his cruel face. Eleanor pushed back against him, her hands on his chest. Seth reached up, gripping her by the wrists as she struggled against him. There was no mistaking who it was or how she'd been tricked, and in that moment she seemed to move to hit him, the motion becoming a blur. Her face turned away from Seth to look hopelessly at the magician. The betrayal in her eyes burrowed into him. Damiola watched as the magic trapped them. There was nothing he could do now, no place or time for regret. He had damned her. But it was hard to believe he couldn't just reach and pull her out of that place. Just for a second he even contemplated it, leaving Seth trapped alone on the other side. But before he could move, they changed, becoming ghosts as they slipped out of time. He hadn't noticed Reuben Glass come down the church steps to stand beside him.
"That deserves a stiff drink, my man. By God, does it. I can't believe that I get to wake up in a London without that bastard Lockwood tomorrow. You don't know what a great thing you've done, magician. What a great, great thing. You've saved us all."
Damiola shook his head, not so much in answer as in denial. They were gone.
"Not her. I didn't save her."
"Collateral damage." The businessman shrugged as if to say such is life.
"The way I see it, it's better some woman I don't know gets hurt than me. And the way things were going, Seth had gone off the deep end. If you'd failed, we'd both be dead by dawn. Losing some real estate is a small price to pay. Lockwood's gone. We're free of his vice-like grip. That makes today a good day, no matter who had to be hurt to make it happen."
"You're all heart," Damiola said.
"Better than that. I'm a free man, magician. Smell that. That fresh air. That's hard-earned, my friend. Every breath is a treasure. He's gone. Think about it for a moment. He's gone. I can't believe it. He's fucking well gone. Look around you. This is what London looks like without that bastard. And it's beautiful. Now try and tell me that's not cause for celebration."
All Damiola could say in answer to him was, "What have we done?"
"One," Glass said.
He wasn't so sure. 38. Clean slate. Seth closed the door behind him. Rosie Raines led the way through to the sitting room, offering him a choice of tea or something stronger and a seat. Seth was all smiles as he took the cup from her. The room was nothing special. There were the obligatory family portraits on the mantelpiece. It was interesting to see his brother's face diluted across a few generations, before it settled unerringly back in the same set of features with Josh.
"I'm sorry to turn up on your doorstep unannounced, especially at this ungodly hour, but I was hoping to catch Josh before he headed out to work."
"He's not been home all night," Rosie said. "I never know whether he's coming or going these days. Not that it makes much difference to him. He lost his job at the magazine when he did his disappearing act after the funeral."
"Some people find it difficult," Seth said, pretending empathy.
"It really is a lovely house you've got here," Seth said, lying through his teeth.
It was anything but lovely by any of the yardsticks he would have used for his own taste. It reeked of the old man who had lived out the last 24 or so years of his life, cooped up in it. There was little of the woman's personality on display. Indeed, since Boone's passing, it had become something of a shrine to him.
"There's a lot of living been done here, that's for sure," she said. "But I don't think I'd call it lovely. Boone was never one for creature comforts, and even after he took us in, well, this was always his house."
"And now it's yours," Seth said.
"But I wish it wasn't,"
Rosie admitted with a resigned shrug.
"I could quite happily have waited another 20 years to inherit a few bricks, given the alternative."
"I'm sure. It must be a hard time for you. Like losing your husband all over again,"
Seth said, watching her reaction. She looked down at her plain slippers, then up, offering a wan smile.
"Thank you for coming to the funeral. It meant a lot."
"It was nothing, honestly. These family feuds can be a bit silly, if you ask me. Best to keep the past where it belongs, rather than keep stirring it up."
She smiled at that, and raised the bone china cup to her lips to take a sip of the steaming drink.
I appreciated it, and what you said. You and Josh, your family, you're the future. I won't be here forever. I worry about what will happen to him. He's a bit...
She seemed to struggle to find the right word, only to settle on...
Lost.
The sickness of us millennials, I'm afraid, Seth said. I can't help but think it was easier before. Now everything is at your fingertips, and you're carrying around the collective knowledge of the world in your pocket. Meet a nice girl. The first thing she does is check out your digital footprint. Where's the romance in that? It was so much easier when it was just that old, old story of boy meets girl.
Quite, Rosie said. And to be honest, sometimes I think he'll never meet anyone. He doesn't even seem all that interested most of the time. I wouldn't mind if he brought a nice young man home, either, if that's what he wanted. That's all a mother wants, you know, for her kids to find someone nice to settle down with and be happy. That's not so much to ask, is it?
Very enlightened of you, Rosie. I can't imagine old Gideon reacting the same way if I'd brought a charming young man home. Seth laughed at the thought of it. The woman was annoying him in a perfectly useless suburban housewife kind of way. Her entire world revolved around these four walls, the extent of her horizons the end of the cul-de-sac they lived on, or stretching it, the short line of shops around the corner.
It's what makes the world go around, Rosie.
You don't mind if I call you Rosie, do you?
No, that's fine. We're family after all,
she simpered. It made his skin crawl.
Rosie,
he smiled with his most ingratiating smile, like a salesman offering the world. He shook his head.
It's so hard to grasp, after all this time, growing up alone, thinking there was just me, looking at the way my grandfather ruled this place with a rod of fear, me hidden away from the world.
He enjoyed that line. That was clever. That was almost telling the truth.
You start to think that's all there is to life, that this small circle of people around you is everything.
I can imagine,
Rosie Rain said. Of course she could. He was describing her life.
If I'm honest, it gets so lonely, he said.
Again that grain of truth as he thought about Glasstown, about the year he'd spent trying to convince Eleanor Rains to love him like he loved her, and how all of that time together just left him feeling lonelier than he ever had before. But she didn't love him. She didn't even like him. That made Glasstown his prison as much as it was hers. He'd thought about killing her not so long ago, and had come close to doing just that. If he couldn't have her, then no one would. But, when it came right down to it, he couldn't bring himself to do it. That was when he'd left her to rot. He'd always known there was a weakness in Damiola's design, a crack where one of the lenses was flawed, that allowed him to slip in and out of that place. It had happened 20 years after they had disappeared. A Luftwaffe bomb hit the street and tore away one side of the building. It was a miracle the glass had survived at all. He could have killed her and walked away, into the 21st century, and no one would have been any the wiser. It was a case of be careful what you wish for. Given his time again, he'd even come to think he'd swap places with Isaiah, let his brother have the girl after he'd used her up. There were always prettier girls. There were always more willing women. He had money. He had power. He could have anything he wanted in this place. It didn't have to be Eleanor Rains. So what had made him do it then? He thought, looking at the woman across from him. He could have her if the whim took him. She wouldn't fight much, and the fighting only added to the thrill as far as he was concerned. So why Eleanor? The answer was simple. She was in love with his brother. His brother didn't get to win. He breathed deeply, needing to bring his focus back to the here and now before the bitterness and anger slipped through.
And suddenly I find I've got a whole new family I'd never heard of. It's like getting a second chance at life, Rosie. Maybe that's a bit melodramatic, but I'm sure you know what I mean.
Look at us sitting here having a nice chat. Me and my new... aunt? I guess that's right. It's really something, isn't it?
She smiled at that.
It is, she agreed. Did you know about me?
Seth asked, wondering if she would admit it, even if she had. She raised her cup to her lips again, taking another sip before answering.
Not really. You have to remember I'm married into the family. I'm not a Raines by birth, not like Josh or Barclay. I never knew Catherine. She was already dead before I met her son. There was only ever Boone, and he didn't talk much about the past. Barclay certainly didn't. I don't know what had happened between them, but he hated anything to do with the family.
Seth resisted the temptation to say that he'd been there the day her husband died, in that little tobacconist's, or that he'd brought to life the kid, just like the comedians, and made sure the knife was rammed home before he allowed the demon to fade. The old grudges ran deep. He'd thought he was ending Isaiah's line at the time. He'd made a mistake. He wouldn't make another one. He leaned forward in his seat, hands cupped around the warmth of the bone china.
I want to know everything about you guys. Josh, his sister. I don't suppose you've got any old home movies or anything? Oh, there's a few, on tape somewhere. I'll see if I can rustle something up for you to have a look at.
That would be wonderful, Seth said.
You can't have had it easy growing up, Rosie said.
He barked out a sharp, bitter laugh at that.
You could say that. It was certainly an experience. The kind of stuff happening around me as I grew up. The people and the way they were all so afraid of the old man. It colours how you see the world. You start to think you're untouchable, that violence and crime is a genuine answer. People look at you differently, too. They're frightened of you because of your name.
I can only begin to imagine, but I liked what your grandfather said at the funeral, about the past being dead, wiping the slate clean, about you boys finding each other and starting again. Family's important.
It's everything, Seth agreed.
What time did you say Josh was getting home?
I didn't. I never know whether he's coming or going these days. He's hardly here. After the funeral, I thought he'd done something stupid. He loved that old bugger like a dad, and finding him at the bottom of the stairs like that.
She shook her head. Seth resisted the temptation to say he would have willingly swapped places, or how much he would have enjoyed seeing the old man broken at the bottom of the stairs. One less of his brother's bastard line in the world. Instead, he said,
I was really hoping I'd get to talk to him. I don't suppose you have his mobile number to hand. Maybe we could call him, let him know I'm here. I'm sure he'd come running if he knew I was.
Oh, yes, of course. It's programmed into the phone. I never remember any numbers these days. Not like when I was younger, and you knew maybe a dozen off by heart. Funny how times change, isn't it? We'd be lost without things like speed dial.
Seth smiled.
Would you mind?
Of course not. You boys should get to know each other. Would you like a top-up?
I'm good, Seth said.
He hadn't taken a single sip from his cup.
But if you could find those old tapes while we're chatting, that would be great.
Rosie offered no indication she'd caught the impatience in his tone, but he was going to have to be more careful if he wanted this to work. He offered that salesman smile again as she picked up the old plastic phone's receiver and pressed the top button, speed dial one, making the call to the most important person in her life. The little things you learned about someone just from being observant. Josh came before his sister, Alexandra. It didn't say Lexi. It was her full name. His wasn't. Good to know. Rosie stood while she waited for the call to connect, whispering,
Come on, come on,
into the plastic mouthpiece, then smiled as Josh obviously picked up.
Hello, love. Yes, no, everything's fine, she said. Just wondering where you are. Ah, There's someone here who wants to talk to you. Hold on, love. I'll hand you over.
Seth reached out for the receiver.
Hello, Josh. Cousin Seth here. I've been really looking forward to talking to you.
What the fucking fuck are you doing in my house?
I've just been having a pleasant chat with your mum, cuz. She's truly delightful. I envy you.
What do you want?
I was hoping you'd be here.
If you hurt her, I'll...
Don't be silly. It's fine. It's hardly a wasted journey. I've seen where you grew up. Seen a few family photos.
He looked over at the mantelpiece where the three generations of Rain's men stared back at him.
I've enjoyed myself, and I think Rosie has too. We've bonded over stories of how hopeless our generation is when it comes to matters of the heart.
What do you want, Seth?
I hope what you're doing isn't too important for you to take some time out. I think you and I should have a sit down. Like I said at the wake, we really should get to know each other better.
I don't need to know you better. I know exactly who you are, Seth. I know what you've done, how you betrayed your brother, how you kidnapped Eleanor. I know all about Glasstown.
Do you now?
I found the magician, Seth. Think about that for a moment. He told me how to hurt you. I can end this.
You don't want to do that,
Seth said, choosing his words carefully. He kept that salesman smile on his lips as he leaned back in the chair, projecting an image of easy conviviality.
That's too much, really. A simple get-together at the pub would suffice. You know the place, the Hunter's Horns, on the edge of the estate. I can be there in a few minutes if you want.
It's not happening, Seth. Not in a million years.
I'll be there for a few hours. If you can make it, it would be really great to see you. After all, we're family. You've got to look after your own.
I swear, you raise a finger to her, to either of them, and...
You kill me, cuz. You're a funny, funny guy. I didn't expect that. But you need a sense of humor at a time like this. It's a good quality to have. I'm really looking forward to getting to know you better. I think we're going to be the best of friends.
You don't frighten me, Seth.
I should. It's good that your mum's so close, just around the corner. I can pop by any time to say hi. She's promised to sort some old family movies out for me, so we can have a good old reminisce together.
He looked at her for confirmation that she was indeed going to sort the tapes out. She was already on her knees in front of the big old dresser, rooting through the labels of dozens of VHS cassettes, looking for the past.
You're welcome any time,
she said over her shoulder, just loudly enough for her voice to carry down the line to Josh.
Well, then, there we have it. A standing invite,
Seth said, all smiles.
Fuck you!
All you have to do is stop what you were doing for a little while. That's not such a lot to ask, is it? We really should raise a glass to the old man. Send him off in style. My treat, cuz. What do you say? Clean slate? Come around to the family place. The way I see it, it's as much your inheritance as it is mine. The sins of the past don't belong to us. We've got a chance to be different. Blood. That's my sales pitch.
He smiled at Rosie, who nodded encouragingly.
She begged me to save her from you. That's how much she hates you, Seth. She wants out of the prison you made for her. And I'm going to get her out. I know what I have to do. I know how to stop you.
There's something you really need to know about me, Josh. There's nothing I wouldn't do for my family and the people I love. Nothing. I really am looking forward to seeing you again. I think we understand each other.
39. Positives and negatives.
Jesus fucking fuck!
What? What is it?
He's in my fucking house! Jesus fuck, Julie! He sat there beside my mum, taunting me. Fuck, fuck, just fuck.
Slow down, Julie said.
What did he say to you?
He told me I should be frightened of him.
You should be. I am. Anyone in his right mind would be.
He's not going to win, Julie. He's not. We've got to stop him.
Julie looked at his watch.
Listen to me, Josh. You need to stay calm, okay?
He put his hands on Josh's shoulders and forced him to look him in the eye.
What is this about?
He didn't let Josh answer.
Eleanor Raines. That hasn't changed. Nothing has actually changed, has it?
No, that's not true.
One thing has changed. You know how to beat him, right?
Josh nodded, but it was obvious he was fighting every instinct to head for the stairs and race all the way back to the Rothery, playing right into Seth's hands.
You still know how to beat him, don't you?
Josh nodded again.
Right, so nothing has really changed. You still hold the same hand you did before you picked up the phone. He's trying to call your bluff.
He's in my house,
Josh repeated, as if he could make Julie understand the implications of what that meant by sheer force of will.
I get it. I do. I know what you're dealing with better than anyone. Remember? He killed my partner. I know exactly what he's capable of. But I've put my faith in you. I need you to come through. Otherwise, to be blunt, I'm fucked. So get a grip. What did he want?
To frighten me.
Right. But what did he say? You asked him a couple of times. What did he say?
That he thought I'd be there. That we should take time out. Sit down together. He wants me to go to his family's pub, the Hunter's Horns.
You don't want to do that.
No shit.
No. I mean, if you're going to meet him, it should be neutral ground. Not walking into the belly of the beast. You don't stand a chance on their turf. You've got to be clever about this.
I know exactly what I've got to do. I've got to destroy the anchors Damiola put in place. Shatter them and bring the curtain crashing down on Seth Lockwood once and for all.
It sounds easy when you put it like that, Julie said. Look, do me a favor. Hold fire a couple of minutes. I'm desperate for a piss. Point me in the direction of the bathroom, then we'll head out and do some shattering.
Through that way, Josh pointed.
Julie locked himself in the bathroom, then opened the window. He took his phone from his pocket and dialed the number Seth had put in his contact list. It was picked up on the first ring.
Julie, Julie, Julie. I hope you're calling with good news.
I'm with him now,
Julie whispered, leaning his head out of the window so the wind could blow away his words. It wasn't foolproof, but he needed to get a message to Lockwood without tipping Josh Raines off to the fact that he was playing both sides against the middle.
He's coming for you.
Good. Let him come.
I'm ready. I'll rip his fucking balls off and make yo-yos out of them.
He reckons he knows how to beat you.
Julie hesitated. Not sure he really wanted to throw his lot in with Lockwood. The silence on the other end of the line was expectant. He seriously thought about hanging up, flushing the toilet, and heading out of the flat, out of the city, and then ultimately out of the country. It was a big world. It might all be connected, but you could still disappear if you were willing to forego certain creature comforts.
He said he's going to destroy the anchors. I don't know what that means. But he seems pretty sure it'll fuck you up.
That can't happen, Julie. I'm putting my trust in you now. I need you to handle it.
Look after me, and I'll look after you. That's how this arrangement of ours works. And remember, I know where the bodies are buried. Well, the body, at any rate.
Don't disappoint me. When you know which anchor he intends to target, send word. I'll do the rest.
Seth killed the call. Julie slipped his phone back into his pocket and then closed the window. He flushed the toilet and ran the taps before he unlocked the bathroom door. Josh waited for him at the top of the staircase. No sign that he'd heard the hushed conversation.
Okay, where are we going?
Two choices, an abandoned church or an abandoned cinema. The others are too public.
I'm not a particularly religious guy, Julie said.
And the lens setup is probably easier to find in a cinema, Josh mused, given there's a whole projection room filled with the kind of equipment Damiola would have used.
Makes sense. And it seems fitting, you know, looking for a lost actress in an abandoned cinema. There's something right about it. Where's the cinema?
It's the old one on Latimer Road.
I know it, Julie said.
Too well, Julie thought, remembering vividly what had happened the last time he'd set foot in the place. He had no intention of going back there. At the very least, Taff's blood was still on the floorboards. At the very worst, the woman was still there.
But, you know, there's a lot to be said for an abandoned church, including the whole having fallen out of favor with God thing. Think about it. If you were Lockwood, where would you expect you to go? The cinema, right? Everything about this revolves around movies. Hitchcock's lost film. An actress that disappeared right off the set. Even the place. What did you call it? Glasstown. Used to be a film studio. Our failed attempt at a Hollywood. So if I were him, I'd be expecting you to go to the old Latimer Road cinema. I vote for the church. Try and blindside him. Any advantage we can get, right?
He hoped he'd sold it hard enough without overselling it. He didn't want Josh thinking he was trying to steer him away from the cinema for any reason other than it made sense to try and outthink Lockwood and exploit any slight advantage they could maneuver. He willed Josh to say they were going to the church.
Makes sense, his unsuspecting partner agreed. I'm driving, Julie said, heading for the door. You don't know where you're going, Josh called, heading down after him. That's why you're navigating.
He popped the lock so that Josh could clamber in, and in those few seconds took his phone out to text a single word to Seth. Church. He couldn't be more specific than that, both because of the time it took to type out even a short message, and because he didn't actually know which church was their destination. Seth would, though. He slipped the phone back into his pocket and got in.
What were you doing out there?
Josh asked, as he got in beside the wheel.
Just checking in to see there were no messages from the station. I'm supposed to be on duty in an hour, but that's not happening, obviously.
They drove a while in silence, both men wrapped up in their own thoughts. Julie followed the occasional left, right instructions, resisting the temptation to point out it would be much easier if Josh just told him where they were going. He tried to picture the map scorched into the floorboards and work out where the church was based on their current route, but his mind didn't work that way. He envied the cabbies who, armed with the knowledge, could plot the fastest path between any two points in the city unerringly, taking into account traffic flow and congestion. He could barely manage to find his way through some of the back streets around the Rothery, and he'd been driving them for the best part of a year. He reached down to put the stereo on. He was fidgety and didn't want his passenger to realize just how nervous he was. The CD started playing. It was one of Taff's. It was the absolute last thing Julie wanted to hear. Keeping his eyes on the road, he leaned forward and fumbled with the buttons to switch it over to the radio, picking up the jarring fiddles of the levelers on a slightly off-station absolute radio.
Better,
he said, even as the static crackled across the airwaves. As the streets grew grubbier and darker, so too did the music. It didn't matter. Julie wasn't listening to it anymore. He was trying to figure a way out of the mess he was in. It took another 10 minutes and twice as many turns as they tacked away across the capital, before the church, with its gaping hole where there should have been a spire and bats up in the belfry, came into sight. It looked curiously lopsided, like a caricature of a haunted house up on a green and unpleasant hill, this one surrounded by ring after ring of cracked and broken tombstones. The roof had collapsed over the altar, and several of the stained glass windows were broken, letting the elements in. They parked the car and stood at the old lich gate. It looked like it belonged on a much grander structure than the dilapidated church. Julie looked around. There was no sign of Seth, but that didn't mean he didn't have eyes and ears in place. Weeds had reclaimed the path that wound its way through the gravestones, to the imposing archway where there used to be huge double doors. The greenery turned the granite slabs into tiny cobbles. Immense tree roots rose out of the ground to reach up over some of the graves, while the patron saints set to look over them lay on their sides, chipped, weathered and broken. Julie saw a headless statue atop one of the graves, hands still clasped in prayer. Beside it, words had been hammered into the lead above a sunken mausoleum's door. The sign said, "The flesh also shall rest in hope." The wingless angel lying on her back amid the tall grasses didn't offer much hope, Julie thought bleakly. The old churchyard grounds were heavily forested off to the left, while on the right, red brick factories crowded the skyline. None of the gravestones were regular or whole. Several of the granite skirts that had outlined the shapes of the graves were buckled and balanced precariously, where the ground beneath them had slipped away, forming undulating hills that rippled all the way to the tree line.
"What is this place?"
"An anchor," Josh said.
"There's a lens somewhere here, one of Damiola's glasses."
"How do we find it?" Julie asked, but Josh already had the battered compact in his hand. He turned his back to the derelict church and raised the compact high enough so that it showed the building in the glass.
"Here, look," Josh said urgently. "Can you see it this time? Tell me you can see it."
Julie didn't know what to expect when he looked in the glass, but it wasn't the sight of a halo-like crackle of energy running around the rooftop, or the sight of the spire fully restored, black slates glittering with early morning dew. A two-white line chased through the halo's core, sparking as it passed through the hands of a leering gargoyle perched on the corner of the rooftop. A glint of sunlight reflected off the glass in the gargoyle's grasp.
"I see it," he said. "I don't understand it, but I see it. Up there in the gargoyle's hands."
Josh Raines nodded.
"Damiola's glass. There are 13 of them ringing the perimeter of Glasstown. It never disappeared. It was never redeveloped after the film studio failed. The magician did something that moved it a step out of time, I think, or pushed it through to another place that exists a step out of time from us. On the other side of those lenses, time slows down to the point that 1 year passes in 100 on this side."
Julie shook his head.
"How the fuck is that possible?"
He turned around, looking at the church without its spire. The gargoyle was still in place, though half of his face appeared to be weathered away, to the point that it looked as though the poor creature had had a stroke. The spire wasn't the only thing that was missing. He couldn't see the halo. He looked in the glass again, reassuring himself both were there, then looked back at the reality of the church and its crumbling walls.
"I just don't...
I can't pretend that I understand the where's and why's either. Beyond saying it's magic. But it is what it is. There's no point standing around arguing the physics of it.
This is how we beat Seth. We shatter that lens, bringing down this corner of the illusion. Without it, the magic can't hold. Then we go after the next and the next until there's none left.
Seth was born over a century ago.
All we have to do is wait for time to catch up with him."
"You make it sound simple," Julie said, looking up at the deformed gargoyle.
"As easy as breaking glass."
"What could possibly go wrong?" Julie muttered to himself, looking around for any sign that the gangster had arrived. Behind them, nothing moved, not even the leaves on the trees in the slight breeze. The silence was unnerving.
"So, how? I mean, have you thought about how you're going to get up there?"
Julie pointed up toward the gargoyle that was perched about 20 feet above their heads. It was obvious that he hadn't. He looked about for something to throw at it, crouching down to pick up a fist-sized rock. He threw it and missed by a good 3 feet, the rock powdering part of the old stone where it hit.
"This could take a while," Julie joked.
"Not helping.
Wasn't trying to." Julie glanced back toward the lich gate again. There was no way Seth wasn't going to pull something. He wouldn't just stand by and let them destroy the glass, given just how important it was to his survival. Lockwood had given him one task, convince Josh to let it go. He'd failed abjectly at that. Josh was more determined than ever, but that was Lockwood's fault. He'd gone blundering in his size 12s, threatening Josh's mother. He didn't have to do that. It wasn't big, it wasn't clever, and it made no sense. It wasn't a smart play. The problem, as Julie saw it, was that Lockwood was clever. He was deliberate, manipulative, and dangerous. That he'd pushed Josh into lashing out couldn't be some unforeseen side effect of him trying to be too clever for his own good. He wanted Josh to lash out. Somehow, some way, it benefited him. It had to. But if Josh was right, and that by breaking the lens he'd doom Seth, how could that be winning?
"Who are you expecting to see back there?"
Josh said, a new stone in his hand.
"Just thinking," Julie said. "This is a mistake. We shouldn't be here."
"What?"
"It's a trap. It's got to be. Think about it. Why did he make your mum call you?"
"It was a warning," Josh said. Julie was unconvinced, and would have been even without knowing his own part in the setup.
"Or it was meant to force you into action," he suggested. "This is a man who has lived his life scaring the living fuck out of people. If there's one thing he knows how to do, it's put the frighteners on people. He knew you'd do this, go after the anchors. It's your only way to hurt him. You said so yourself. But look around you. He hasn't tried to stop you. If you accept he's not an idiot, and that he's been one step ahead of you, at least one, every step of the way, that means he wants you to do this. He's counting on it."
Josh shook his head.
"No, no, that's not right. It can't be."
"It has to be," Julie said, realizing the extent of just how badly he'd been lied to.
"He's going to kill you here. You said it yourself, right at the beginning. He's going to kill you. He doesn't want you to stop looking for Eleanor Raines. He wants you dead, like your dad, like your granddad. He wants his brother's line ended, and you're the last. It's all about family for him. And when Isaiah took her name, he stopped being a Lockwood. He stopped being family. He became the enemy."
Josh continued to shake his head, but Julie could see the doubt creeping in. He looked around again, seeing this time all the places Lockwood could be lurking, all the culverts and tumble-down stones, and realizing just how vulnerable they were out there in front of the church.
"We should get out of here. Go if you want. I'm not going anywhere. I came here to destroy the anchor. That's what I'm going to do."
Julie backed up a couple of steps, his feet crunching on the gravel underfoot.
"Don't do this. You're playing into his hands. I know you think this is your idea, but it's not. It can't be. He's too fucking shrewd for that. He's playing you, Josh. He wants you to break that thing."
But Josh wasn't listening. He walked up to the side of the church and reached up, feeling out the crumbling stones for makeshift handholds. A couple of seconds later, he boosted himself up and started to scramble up the side of the church, the cornerstones between his legs. Halfway up, with the gargoyle still out of reach, he leaned back looking for more handholds. It was the kind of stupid maneuver that, had he been unluckier, would have ended with him breaking his neck. But whatever god, angel, or devil who looked after idiots was watching over him. Julie saw Josh reach out for the glass sphere hidden in plain sight within the gargoyle's stone talons. Josh leaned out perilously, straining to tease the glass free with his fingertips.
Julie could hear the sizzle of the current surging unseen through the lens as it chased around the cordon of Glasstown, maintaining the century-old spell. Josh leaned a little farther, his weight very much being taken by the fingers of his left hand as he flapped upward with his right, trying unsuccessfully to dislodge the glass. Julie heard a dog barking in the distance. The sound made him shiver, as though someone had walked over his grave. He didn't like this one little bit. It was all wrong.
"He's going to kill you,"
he said again, even though Josh was too far away to hear. He was absolutely sure of it. And then Josh cried triumphantly, pulling the magician's lens free of the gargoyle's clutches. He held it aloft like Liberty's torch. Then, with what felt like slow-motion horror to Julie, let it spill off the end of his fingertips and fall. It shattered on the chips of stone 20 feet below. The barking intensified, closer, louder, savage now. Julie looked around for the source, expecting to see a pack clawing up the road, snapping and snarling. Nothing. He turned back to look at Josh, and through the open arch where the church doors should have been, saw the shimmering haze of a dark street, and up above he saw a stray moonbeam, and around it, streaks of shooting stars, as if all of those thousands of points of light were falling from the sky. When he looked down from that impossible sky, he saw a dog. Only it couldn't be a dog. It lacked any kind of tone or color, like a photograph in negative. The dark patches of fur were blisteringly bright, its eyes two blazing white spheres in the center of its skull. It tore up the street that was somehow, incredibly, impossibly, through the archway. Behind the negative, deep in the heart of the abandoned church where the movie set street opened up into a Victorian square, he saw a woman in a red dress. He knew her, even across the distance, across the time. She was unmistakable. Eleanor Raines's screams chased the dog as it barreled out through the archway. Still, the rabid animal didn't make a sound, yet the barking all around him intensified in its savagery, the strays of this London raging against its unnatural presence. How many dogs were out there, descending on the derelict church? 10? 20? The pack's howls spiraled, becoming a dizzying cacophony. Julie felt the warmth leach out of the air as the negative prowled toward him, its nearness placing a chill deep in his heart that spread through every vein and artery, putting ice where there had been hope. He felt his vision blur, the dual city within a city before him swimming out of focus as he struggled to cling on to his sense of self. Julie felt himself diminishing, the world around him pitching beneath his feet as he clung to the nearest gravestone to stay upright. The dog closed the distance between them from 30 feet to 10. Julie stumbled back, trying to put precious distance back between them, but in doing so, lost his grip on the headstone, and with it, his footing. He went down, unable to take his eyes off the negative as it loomed over him, salivating, strings of black spittle stretched out between sharp teeth. The negative pressed him down, claws on his chest. He could see the rapid rise and fall of its ribcage, the flare of its nostrils, those strings of spittle snapping as its white eyes burned, but it still didn't make a sound. He clawed at the ground, trying to push himself up, but the weight on his chest kept him pinned to the dirt. Try as he might, there was no getting out from under the beast. Julie wriggled desperately beneath the negative, but couldn't dislodge it. Its breath tasted strange on his face. It wasn't brimstone or anything hellish. It was blandly chemical. He reached up to push the thing off, and where his hands came into contact with the negative's flesh, they came away stained black. He couldn't feel anything. No tightness of skin, no burning. Those two white eyes stared through him. Those eyes were fierce. The negative lowered its mouth to feed, teeth opening as it sought out the heat of his pulse in his throat. When he thought all was done, the negative's black teeth inches from sinking into his meat, he willed himself gone, out of his head, somewhere it couldn't hurt. The pain never came. The grotesque monstrosity stopped and tilted its head, nostrils flaring as it sniffed at the air. Once, twice, three times, its head swept.